Download. Steppenwolf actor and Veep star Gary Cole. Former Chicago Bear great Doug Blank. And comedian and author Jen Kirkman. And now, here's your host, a man who won't stop using office-based quotes in his everyday vocabulary, Justin Kaufman.
I don't know what you're talking about, Peter.
I actually like to get him wrong.
You wish you knew, Peter.
I'm the king of that. I think I'm doing the quote, but I'm actually doing it wrong.
How's it going, Peter?
That's not... No, you got it wrong. I do that all the time. I do it... I get... All my friends get... My brother, especially, gets really frustrated with me when I'm like, it's the Big Lebowski. I'm like, hey, man, that's like your opinion, man. He's like, that's not the line. I'm like, all right, man. Same with the office space.
What's going on, Peter? How can we help you, Peter?
Office space? And they're like, no, you're wrong. Stop. You're ruining it. Welcome to The Download, everybody. I'm Justin Kaufman here on 720 WGN Radio. Thanks for joining us tonight. We appreciate the company. Got an amazing show lined up for you tonight. It's crazy. I'm not sure how we're going to fit all of this in. When we start with the news tonight, Mike Fouché is going to be here to talk about the police task force study. What does it mean that the police department's broken and that it's got to be blown up? What does that mean? That plus looking at the education funding proposal from Governor Rauner. Are we saving money? Are we getting money? Are we losing money? What's happening with Chicago public schools and state funding? Also tonight, Chicago actor and Steppenwolf ensemble member Gary Cole. Cole, of course, is one of the best character actors working today. From Bill Lumberg from Office Space to his new role on Veep, Gary Cole's always working. He's always entertaining. We'll talk with him about the Chicago International TV Awards that are coming through next week. He'll be on after 9 o'clock tonight. Another up-and-comer, Chicagoan Brad Morris. You can see Brad on pretty much every great television show the Second City alum, you know, is on Dice. He's on Bajillion Dollar Properties on CISO, which is awesome. That's got a ton of Chicago talent. You can see him on Playing House on USA, another great show. Brad is everywhere, and he also pays the bills. I think he's in every third commercial that you see, especially in sports time. You'll see Brad Morris from Second City all over the place. But Brad's going to be on the show coming up after, I think after Gary Cole, right? Somewhere in that area. We'll find it after 9 o'clock. They're all on LA time. That's the thing, you know. Also tonight, comedian Jen Kirkman. She's a big-time stand-up who's also a bestseller. Her new book, I Know What I'm Doing and Other Lies I Tell Myself, is out, and we'll talk to her about what to share and not to share on stage. How about some sports? You guys want to talk sports? I've always wanted to talk to good old number 46. Bears great Doug Blank joins me to talk about cage rattling hits and, of course, life after football, those cage rattling hits. Doug Blank! How cool is that? He needs a nickname. I mean, he had a nickname, but he needs a nickname like the Plankster. We need to come up with a tonight, everybody. You got an hour or so before Doug Blank, so we need to come up with some nicknames for him. And don't forget about musicians. New York-based singer-songwriter and violinist Esther Ballant is at the Hideout tonight, 10 o'clock show for SimFest. I highly, highly recommend this performance. I don't even know what to call the music. I kind of was like, it's like haunting jazz slash rock slash, it's like, you know what it's like? It's like the beginning of True Detective. That's what Esther's music is like. She's got a new album. She's here for SimFest. She's also was Louis C.K.'s love interest on the FX show Louis. She was a Hungarian neighbor where she didn't speak English. That was tremendous television. Esther will be here in studio tonight. And Johnny Gioeli, the hard rock and frontman for bands like Hardline and Brunette. He's working on a solo project. We'll talk with Johnny about the heyday of hard rock and what happened when it was over. I mean, we talked to Lita Ford about that, the idea that in a blink of 2 months when Nirvana and Smashing Pumpkins and all those bands came on the scene, the hard rock bands of that weren't named Guns N' Roses or Metallica all suffered in the Billboard charts, and a lot of people lost record deals, including Johnny. So we'll talk with Johnny coming up in the 10 o'clock hour. Did I get it all? I feel like I got it all. That's a crazy... Oh, man, that's a lot of stuff. Let's get to it. Whew. Wow. News, weather, and traffic with Rob Martier and Esmeralda Leon. Production provided by Pete Zimmerman. I'm Justin Kaufman, and this is The Download, a show about Chicago, starring those who know it well. All right, beautiful night here on Michigan Avenue. Looking out, everybody's out. This is the beginning of spring. I feel it. I feel it. All right, why don't we start with the carryout? This, of course, is our nightly segment where I read the newspaper, so you at home, you don't have to. Here are today's top stories. Hey, it's nice that an executive pleaded guilty to kickbacks in the parking meter deal, isn't it? It's nice. It's always nice to read when you wake up in the morning. How did I get screwed over 10 years ago? Oh, here it is. How one person made $22 million off installing one of the crappiest deals in Chicago history. Hey, at least somebody made money off the deal. He should have to pay the money back in quarters. What do you think? Good idea. So now it comes out that Denny Hastert spent time in his political career railing against child abuse and child molesters. Really? I guess that's better than the gay congressman railing against gay rights. This after yesterday's motion from defense lawyers that groin massages don't count as sexual abuse. This after lawyers asked for no jail time because Hastert, he's just too sick. Wow, this case is using all the plays in the old playbook. What's next? The lawyer's going to rhyme? If he touched the groin, you got to give the coin. That was my best Johnny Cochran. The Cubs have widened sidewalks on Addison in front of Wrigley. Wait, you could just do that? I want to widen my sidewalk. Yeah, for security reasons. The truth is, the sidewalk on Addison just east of Clark is way too narrow. We all know that. But I think they should go further. I say widen and install outdoor troughs. Huh? Think of the efficiency alone. The New York primary's coming up. Are you excited? I hate when New York does this. National media is like, hey, have you heard of a primary? The first one is coming up here in New York City, and the world is standing still. This is the biggest moment in the history of history. Now let's eat a plain hot dog and runny pizza. Wake me up when it's the midterm elections. Senator Mark Kirk announced today he's going to skip the GOP convention this year. He's like, listen, it just sounds like it's going to be a clown show. So, and I would know, I'm a senator. I mean, it's a full-blown three-ring circus under that rotunda. Who hears from the south side? Okay, all right. Getting closer to some new amenities along the Chicago Riverwalk, a floating garden, and a fountain for kids. I don't know about you, but I'm going to skip the Chicago River fountain for kids. I like my kids without Chicago River water. Still, looks like it's going to be cool. In weather, can you taste it? No, it's not the river. That's the taste of spring. In sports, the Blackhawks lost game one to a technicality. Tomorrow night, game two. But the good news is that the Hawks' penalty killing was on point, as well as their defensive performance overall. The bad news, the defense was so good that it scored the only goal. Freak losses are one thing. Freak losses in the playoffs? Ugh, I need a drink. How about Kobe Bryant scoring 60 in his last game? That's the equivalent of Brett Favre sliding down to let Michael Strahan break the sack record. Remember that? Kobe Bryant proving once again that basketball is, yeah, it's an individual sport. The Golden State Warriors won their 73rd game last night to break the Bulls' record for most regular season wins. I think I respectfully speak for all Chicagoans when I say, go San Antonio. The Bulls brass did their post-mortem last night after the season ended, you know, when everyone was watching other sports. Smart move, since the press conference essentially was, hey, you know what? I know we suck, but we're not really going to make any changes. So, hey, let's go watch the end of that Hawks game. The Sox swept the winless Twinkies this week in Minnesota. Today, they continued their hot streak with a 4-1 win. Hey, we said right here on The Download, they had to start fast. And guess what? They are hot. The Cubs are playing tonight. Is it me? Or is it kind of weird that the Cubs have yet to have a day game at Wrigley Field? This whole series against the Reds has been night games. I don't know, maybe they make more money at night. More nacho sales. Oh, man, it's 9:30. I wish I could get some more nachos. Oh, there's so many nachos. And in football, I know I said I wouldn't talk about the draft till closer to the draft, but the newly minted L.A. Rams traded up for the number one pick today. How about that? I like that moxie. They are rumored to take a quarterback or actress Meryl Streep. You know, L.A. Rams. And finally, the head of AMC Theaters hinted that they may allow patrons to text when they are at the movies. You know what? I, for one, agree. Imagine sitting through Independence Day 2 without any distraction. That sounds like torture. That's the carryout for April 14th, 2016. Hey, did you order the beef? You want it dipped? Come on, do it. Dip it. You gotta dip it. Everybody dips it. Much, much more to come. Mike Fouché is going to be here from Alder Track to talk about the big police task force study about the racism and the broken system that is the Chicago Police Department. We'll talk with him coming up here after the news. It's a download here on 720 WGN. Stay with us. All right. Coming up, Mike Fouché. Pete, I need you to keep track of this. Rob Martyr joins us now. Rob, good to talk to you. Good to see you, buddy.
Good evening. Good to be here.
All right. So the Bears schedule is out.
Yeah.
And it's time for our annual Rob Martyr's quick take.
Let's do it.
Are you ready?
Go.
Texans.
Loss.
Eagles.
Win.
Cowboys.
Loss.
Lions.
Win.
Colts.
Win.
Jaguars.
Loss.
Packers.
Loss.
Vikings.
Loss.
Buccaneers.
Win.
Giants.
Loss.
Titans.
Win.
Niners.
Win.
Lions.
Win.
Packers.
Loss.
Redskins.
Loss.
Vikings.
Win.
All right. What do we got, Pete? What is it? This is the Rob Martyr quick take. What the Bears are going to do in 2016. What do we got?
8-8.
8-8. There you go. Rob Martyr.
And that was not planned, by the way.
That was not planned. I caught him off guard, and that was fast. That was good. 8-8. I can buy an 8-8, right? I mean, this team came off of 6-10. So 8-8. I mean, Rob gave him two game improvements.
Baby steps.
You don't look like you're loving it.
No, as soon as that thing came out, I looked at it and I was like 16-0. I don't see a loss on that schedule.
I can see that. Yeah.
They don't get back to back home games, and I'll go through this in my sports as well. But the Bears don't get back to back home games until late in the season.
Oh, well, that's probably good based on last year when they lost a ton of games at Soldier Field.
Right.
So. It's a download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, what a week for Mayor Emanuel. The police task force study came out, essentially calling the past of the Chicago Police Department riddled with racism.
Yep.
It's broken.
Yep.
That there's a lot that has to be done, including blowing up and changing the way that policing is done here in Chicago. Mike Fouché joins me from aldertrack.com. I got to say, I mean, there was a lot of talk about, you know, talking the talk and walking the walk.
Right.
You know, like Mayor Emanuel, after the Laquan McDonald video, he was talking the talk. He had put this task force together.
Right.
And there were a lot of people who were skeptical that anything was going to get done.
So the task force was really an excellent, very, very strong group of people led by Lori Lightfoot, who is a very well-respected attorney and has some background with criminal justice. From what I understand, actually, what I was told is that Lightfoot wrote most of the report, which is 180-something pages. She definitely wrote the executive summary, which is about 20 pages. And there were 39 people that were on the Police Accountability Task Force, and really about 7 of them were the ones who really contributed the most, which included Deval Patrick, the former governor of Massachusetts.
There was a lot of concern that there weren't enough Chicago people on that board, that it was just wonks at the top when it was put together.
Yeah, well, you know, they held 4 community outreach meetings. The last one actually was disastrous and completely fell apart, and people stormed the stage and the police had to come and push people away. And they also held 3 meetings with high school kids in order to talk about what are the youth concerns. So what they came out with was really, really pretty strong. And I just want to start with the first sentence.
We've arrived. There was a lot of the word
That's
arrived.
Right.
We've arrived
right.
was used a lot in this
the
executive summary.
The very first sentence is a painful but necessary reckoning is upon us.
Wow.
That is what these times demand. Now,
that sounds like blockbuster movie.
I mean, well,
style.
This is like Moby Dick kind of writing. You know, I mean,
in
it's pretty intense. Yeah, right. And I think that as you read the report, there are no punches pulled. And I would argue that it is probably the strongest worded city-sponsored report I've ever seen.
And it's amazing that there would be that much colorful language at the top of any city-sponsored report. Usually it's like, welcome to this report.
Right. And so they get to, after a couple of pages of intro, they get to these findings. And the findings, these are pretty stark. The first is, we arrived at this point because of racism. We arrived at this point because of a mentality in the Chicago Police Department that the ends justify the means. We arrived at this point because of a failure to make accountability a core value and imperative within CPD. We arrived at this point because of a significant investment in human capital. That's strong stuff. And what they go on to do is use data and information about why that's the case, why there are more African-Americans and Latinos. Well, not why, but showing that there are more African-Americans and Latinos being arrested, being shot, that there are huge number of cases filed against police that are going nowhere, that there are thousands of complaints that end up not being addressed or there being no disciplinary action whatsoever. And then they dive in to figure out, well, why is this sort of thing happening? And they actually made 25 specific recommendations
as to why
there should be
changes. Now, let me ask you this, because Mayor Emanuel, obviously this is a positive in the sense that a task force was not sort of toothless that put something out and everyone went, oh, right.
Right. Here we go.
Like, but does he want that? I mean, does he like the idea that a task force came back saying, you know what, 25 recommendations, how to change this thing that needs to be blown up?
Yeah.
That, he's got to be a little bit feeling the pressure of that.
You know, it's tough to say. So the originally, according to my sources, originally the report was supposed to come out today. And then it was pushed. The Chicago Tribune got a leaked copy and published the copy of an early draft of the executive summary on Tuesday. So they scrambled in order to release the full report yesterday. The mayor had his regular post-city council press briefing at 1 o'clock yesterday afternoon, which I went to, and there were a number of questions. What do you think about this report? And the mayor said, I haven't seen it. And he hadn't seen it yet. As of 1 o'clock, he says he hadn't seen it and he hadn't been briefed. And so then an hour later, after the mayor's presser, the Police Accountability Task Force released theirs. And Lori Lightfoot said, I am presenting this to the mayor at 4:15. So nobody could say, what did the mayor think?
Yeah, right.
What is this all about? You know, what's going to happen next? And there has been no statement. Now, I mean, some of these things, you know, are rough. I mean, the task force says the collective bargaining agreement with the police union needs to be scrapped because there are things that are out of step
that
aren't national.
And standards. I want to get to those recommendations. We'll do that after the break. I think we can continue with this. But that's the only hesitation I have is it too pie in the sky? Meaning, you know, saying you're going to scrap a collective bargaining agreement, we see how that's working in Springfield.
Yeah.
You can't just say that and it gets done. I mean, the mayor doesn't have that kind of power and authority, even if he wanted to. So is this task force based in reality?
You know, I think one of the things that's interesting about what's happened with Mayor Emanuel is that he hasn't had very many big moonshots, things that he has attempt to say, I'm going to completely change the face of our city. And the Laquan McDonald scandal, or whatever you want to call it, all the things that surrounded that, has brought his administration to a grinding halt in a lot of ways. There's very few big things that he's introduced.
Yeah.
And so he's going to have to, if he has to address this. Now, whether or not he chooses to grab the bull by the horns and go with it, you know, is a big question. There's a fight. Either he's going to have a fight with the forces that be within the police department, or I think that he's going to have no chance whatsoever of getting reelected.
Mike Fouché from All the Tracks, my guest tonight. He's here pretty much every week, Wednesday or Thursday.
Hey.
You know, Thursday tonight because the Blackhawks were last night. All right, let's take a break. Come back. I want to talk about what some of those recommendations are.
Yeah.
It's a download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. All right. Yeah, nice little bike coming through here on Michigan Avenue.
Wow, that is, it's like a recumbent.
It's a recumbent.
It looked wheelchair. Like, yeah. Or it was a wheelchair? I don't know what it was. Motorized. It was
still
cool.
Can't be on the sidewalk. But the Mike Fouché from AlderTrack here in studio. We're talking about the Police Accountability Task Force or Task Board, I guess.
Task Force.
The Task Force study that came out this week that was very, very powerful. Used a lot of powerful language.
Yeah.
And it did recommend some changes in the police department.
It did. So first off, anybody can check this out at chicagopatf.org. That's the Chicago Police Accountability Task Force. You can read to your heart's content, 180 pages. It's actually pretty well written. So, you know, they go down there. It's broken up into three things or four things: community police relations, legal oversight and accountability, early intervention and personnel concerns, de-escalation, and video release. That's five. So, you know, the video release obviously is they think that videos of things from body cams and dash cams need to be released faster.
Well, that's interesting. That's
and
a
that
change.
There needs
from,
to be a written policy about it.
Right.
There are a lot of other things, too. Like, for instance, they want to create a community safety oversight board, which is staffed by civilians. They want to create a police inspector general that has the power to inspect the police department, which currently the inspector general does not. They want to create a whole series of community summits, citywide summits on policing. They want to create an inspector general for, they want to create a diversity deputy chief who is going to be in charge of increasing diversity at the police department. They recommend building a new police academy. The current police academy is too small.
Oh.
They want to have more spending on training. One of the big arguments is that police officers today, after they finish the police academy, are not required to do any mandatory training. And most of the training at all are videos that they watch during roll call and when they start their shift.
Right.
There's a whole series of things. The one very interesting thing is they want to create an anonymous hotline that police officers can call so that they could report things that they've seen before. They want to create a whole new accountability system where you're tracking when people are disciplined or should receive
these discipline. These all sound like great ideas. I mean, you know, as much as my last question about how do you pie in the sky make this kind of thing happen, these changes obviously just on first glance seem like they can be done pretty easy. Just going to cost money. It's just going to cost money.
It's going to cost money, but more importantly, it's going to require a big change in culture. You know, the idea that you're going to have to go and make changes to how you do discipline and then tracking whether or not the discipline has been carried out, that's a big change in the police department. A lot of that stuff, it's just sort of up to the reporting officer, and then that's it.
Let me ask you about the council, about the FOP. The mayor hasn't made any statement, but what are you hearing about this task force study? I mean, has it all been positive, or is there like, no?
I think, well, first off, it's too soon. Council members really haven't been ready to talk about it yet. But
they need at least 3 months.
Well, you know, it's hard to read. And so I think one of the things they need to do is really kind of figure out, well, how far are they going to go on this? I mean, there is a lot of politics here. You asked the important question, which is, what does the FOP think? The FOP has been relatively quiet, if only to say that they are concerned that there's some language in there that's not correct. But that's it. I think, you know, one of the things it talks about here is that the current collective bargaining agreement that exists is not up to national standards, and that the current bargaining agreement shields police officers from having to go through certain disciplinary measures, and then after 5 years, all of their complaints are thrown away. That's not done anywhere else. Yeah. In other cities, you can search complaints. You know, average person
and that's
can
been
search
a, problem
a complaint
as well as we've seen that story come up with some of the latest stories.
Right.
Okay, so does Mayor Emanuel has a track record of telling task force and police boards to shove it? I'm going my own way.
Right. Sticking on a shelf.
Exactly.
Shelf.
Thanks for doing that. Thanks for wasting the money. But
see
I'm the
later.
Mayor. I'll do whatever I want to do.
And there was another report three, 4 years ago called the Safer Report, led by a guy last name Safer, that also just ended up on a shelf. And it wasn't as strong as this.
Is that
a
concern? I mean, is there a thought that the mayor could not adapt any of this stuff and just say, you know what, thanks for the work. Thanks, guys.
He's got two pressures. The first is that the African-American and Latino community in Chicago, none of this stuff that's in here is news.
Right.
You know, and so there's going to be increasing pressure for this sort of thing to be implemented. The second is that there is a Justice Department investigation, and the Justice Department investigation, it'll probably be another 15 months or so before it's completed. But the Justice Department could potentially have the force of a court order in order to force the city to do things. It could force a change in the collective bargaining agreement. It could force the city to implement all kinds of things.
So it's
and that would
like,
be horribly, horribly embarrassing for
right.
the mayor
it's almost
if the
like
Justice Department ordered things that had already been recommended
to him. A college
to
basketball program that sanctions itself before the NCAA does. I mean,
right.
the same concept that the city, it was the city going to sanction themselves, the police department sanctions themselves
right.
before the Justice Department
right.
does.
Right, right.
All right, so we'll put this aside for now because there's going to be a lot more. In the next couple of weeks, you're going to hear sides kind of figure this
huge.
Out. The other story that kind of came and went this week was about education funding.
Right.
A proposal with Governor Rauner down in Springfield saying, you know what, I want to change the way that funding is done. Here's a
right.
new formula.
Right.
Everyone's going to get more money.
It's a brilliant plan.
And the CPS chief, Forrest Claypool, yeah. he lost it. He went reverse Robin Hood. He talked about Mississippi in the 60s.
Right.
Like he was like, this is not good. And he estimates that the Chicago Public Schools are going to lose hundreds of millions of dollars.
Well, I don't know hundreds of millions, but the study that was done by the Illinois State Board of Education, which is mostly people appointed by Bruce Rauner, showed that Chicago would lose about $74 million a year in this new plan. The idea of the funding plan and the funding formula is really super squishy. You know, there's an existing funding formula that Illinois has that everyone around the state hates. And the way that it distributes money is very bad. Everyone agrees it doesn't work well. And it tends to give more money to wealthy districts than poorer districts that have to carry more students. The Rauner plan, it actually does send more money to a lot of wealthy districts. Not all of them.
I was going to say, it seems to double down on
but
the same concept.
Wilmette gets a lot more money, while communities like Robbins in the south suburbs lose money.
And that's based on students. There's a formula there. And then
there is a formula.
But it doesn't take into account some of the things that are happening in poverty-stricken areas
right.
where people are leaving or kids aren't going to their school because of choice, things like that.
And also how many kids there are that need special education, how many kids there are that are on aid. That's an issue. So, you know, I think that that's getting to be a bigger and bigger deal. Mayor hates it, obviously. I think that it's going to be fought about in the state legislature. This is just one more salvo in a bigger fight.
Mike Fouché from AlderTrack, a subscription news letter that covers all things Chicago
Let's
and
get
Springfield.
Letter.
Letter.
Let's be very official. Yes,
thanks for being here. We will catch up with you next week, or actually the week after.
Yeah, looking forward to it.
Welcome back to The Download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, my next guest is a singer, songwriter, violinist. Esther Ballant just released her latest album, Airless Midnight. She's touring the Midwest with a show tonight at The Hideout as part of SimFest. It's hard to put Ballant's music in a category, and I'm not sure that doing that would give her music justice. The haunting lyrics, the violin, the guitar, it almost makes for, I was thinking like a grungy cabaret. It's a very intimate music. The Hungarian-born, New York City-raised Ballant is also an accomplished actress, starring in Jim Jarmusch's Stranger Than Paradise, Woody Allen's Shadows and Fog, and just recently opposite Louis C.K. in the show Louie. She played Louis's Hungarian love interest and neighbor, Amya. Esther Ballant, welcome to The Download.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's great to meet you. The grungy cabaret, what's your response to that? I mean, am I close?
I love juxtaposing two things like that seem a little bit polar opposite, so I love that part. Cabaret for me is a term I have trouble with a little bit because mm-hmm. certain things come to mind that
what
are
comes
a little
to
bit
mind, like
shticky or
oh, right.
But that may not be what you think of when
no,
you say
I think
cabaret.
Smoky backroom, smoky European, a little bit more intimate music.
Yeah, okay, that's appropriate.
Welcome to the cabaret. No, not that.
or just yeah. I think that the fact that you said it's hard to categorize, thank you for that. Well, I appreciate that because I think that's accurate.
It has. I mean, it's really – I really love the music. The new record's great.
Thank you so much.
It's a very I think haunting's the right mm-hmm. word. It's a very – I don't want to say dark because it's also melodic and it's also it's very beautiful. But it is. It has roots. It feels like in jazz music. It has roots in maybe a little bit more of a classical because of the mm-hmm. violin, and it seems to have roots in rock and roll.
Definitely, and people have said folk and blues and some rootsy things in there. So it's a combination, and I think that haunting is the word I've heard a lot about my music in general, but this record in particular. And you know what term I've heard a lot about this record? Noir, film noir in music. Like,
yeah, it feels like a soundtrack. Like it almost has a, I hate to, this seems so stereotypical, but like a True Detective feel to it, you know?
Hey, that's not bad. I'll take that.
Right.
I'll definitely
well, you know,
take
for
that.
You, you've had, almost lived two lives. I mean, in the idea that you, I mentioned the credits you've had, and I didn't even mention Trees Lounge, which is a great movie. But
I love Trees Lounge.
But those were movies after that time, you took some time off to essentially just do music. Why did you, that's why did you make that change?
I moved out to Los Angeles in 1989, 90, and I was sort of involved in the music, in the film business out there. And eventually that environment, which is so focused on film business in a way that is not to my taste and liking, I just basically lost interest in the whole thing.
The idea of like always having to go audition
exactly,
and find a job.
The casting world, the breakdowns, the desperation. But I always tell people that also acting is something I sort of happened into, and I think I needed to find my way back to it in this way. Now I'd be really into doing it again, but at that time I think I had to kind of tackle something that I felt was really my own. Acting is also something that you're not in control of what you're doing. I think I was, at the risk of sounding pompous, a little bit too creative for just being told what to do in someone else's project. I had a certain drive to contribute to having something to say. I've always written words, and so
and you find that in music.
Yes, very much so. Yeah,
I'm fascinated with your background, your childhood, because you know you may have come onto acting or come onto music, but performance has always been a part
absolutely
of your family's history. Talk about the early days of your family and the theater performances and troupe that they were in.
Yes, well, I was born into that situation. My father was, and my mother to a lesser extent, but my father was absolutely devoted to the theater. From when I was a little kid and hungry, I remember like making up little avant-garde performances of my own. And I'm saying avant-garde because they really were informed by that aesthetic of my dad and his friends and the people who would come over to our house. My grandfather was also an artist. He was a painter primarily, but he was also a poet and did a lot of other visual arts and a beautiful, amazing artist. So anyway, it was sort of in my blood.
Yeah, right. I mean, obviously, you know, I said at the beginning you're a singer-songwriter, but you're also a violinist. Mm-hmm. Where does that training come from? Where does your mastering of the violin come from?
Well, I'm not sure I'd call it mastering, but I play well within my means. Let's put it that way. So my mom, I think, suggested the actually, you know what? There's a kind of funny story that goes with that. So George Kortog was a family friend. Does that name ring a bell?
No.
He's become quite renowned. He's a great composer. And my mother's story is, I don't know if this is true, but I'll take her word for it, that she had wanted me to study the piano, and she took me to see him. And he was a family friend, really good friends with my grandfather. And he looked at my hands and he said, but she has violin playing hands. And so that's it. And I studied classical violin. I had a great teacher when I was a little kid who taught me some really good foundational principles. And then like most kids who study an instrument at a young age, I totally flaked out, dropped it, stopped practicing. By age 15, I basically retired from my violin career because I didn't want to be a classical violinist.
Right. You don't see a lot of classically trained violinists make a move into more, I guess, rock and roll based or you see it more in jazz, but to make a move into more, I guess, mainstream music. Why is that?
I'm not sure. I don't know. The classical world is a very insular world, and I had no desire or intention to pursue that world with the violin, which is why I quit. I had too many other interests, and it really became like a practical thing later when I transitioned back around into doing my own music, where I thought, well, this could serve, those years of torturous practice could now finally serve their purpose in this context.
I'm talking with a musician, singer-songwriter, violinist, actress Esther Ballant. She's going to be at the Hideout tonight as part of SimFest. That show starts at 10:30?
10:15,
right in there. Yeah. That's a soft 10:15.
Yeah.
Esther, we'll take a quick break. When we come back, more about. I want to talk about Airless Midnight.
Great, thank you. It's harder than I thought.
We can. Sometimes, babe, we're bored out of our skulls. That's tonight, tonight. That's just up to us. It's an easy one-night job. It's a grief.
That's the track. Let's Tonight It off of Airless Midnight. It's 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. That's the artist Esther Ballant, who's in studio with me tonight. She's a singer, songwriter, violinist, actress. I mean, you were in Jim Jarmusch's Stranger Than Paradise, which is, what, like 20 years old?
Try 30.
30 plus years. I can get my years together.
Well, maybe not plus. Maybe it's not quite 30, right. But it's close to 30, something like that.
I mean, 25 for Woody Allen's Shadows and Fog, and then Trees Lounge, 20 years.
Trees Lounge?
Yeah, because it was 1995, 96.
That doesn't seem 20 years ago, but okay if you say so.
There's a great line in that movie that I've always loved is where Steve Buscemi is sitting at the bar, and he says, so you were in Korea? And he goes, what career?
You know what? I had accidentally caught that movie on, I think, IFC Channel at home just about a year ago. And I hadn't seen it in so long, so I decided to sit and watch it. Because you watch things very differently when you don't expect to see it. And you don't come into it with, like, I'm going to sit down and see if it's still any good. Or if it's... it was great. It stands up really well today.
That's great to hear. I didn't look it up. All right. So I'm interested in, like I said earlier, I feel like the music's very intimate. What drives you to create that kind of music? I mean, talk about your relationship with connection.
Oh, wow. It's one of the best questions I've ever been asked. Seriously. That's what it's about. And I feel like that's where you can keep from getting bored, is you can always go deeper. And that's what intimacy is about. I think with intimacy, it's not a finite thing. You can always, it may not be pleasant. It may not be what you want or expect, but there's always more layers in there and crevices to go into. And that's keeps it interesting for me. It's never boring.
You feel that. I mean, you feel like you're very, I don't want to say comfortable, but you're comfortable and you're also... aware that this is a very, not to overuse the word, but intimate experience. Like it feels like you're really connected to the music and to the music that you're producing. So how do you want your audience to interact with it or to receive that music?
Well, I love the idea that they can feel that connection, but they can interpret it totally their own way and make it their own. The lyrics, I think, are a big part of it all for me. And I usually start with the lyrics. And I feel like I'm telling stories, but I feel like they're open-ended enough to where the listener can feel something universal about the connection, but then can project their own particular details. And I think most art that I like works a bit like that.
You got back into acting with Louis C.K.
That's right.
Louis, the season where he meets his neighbor, Amya, from Hungary, who is only there for a month and doesn't speak English.
Mm-hmm.
It's really great television because it doesn't play for jokes. It doesn't play for... It's very Louis C.K. Just this week we were talking about Baskets, which is the other
part. I haven't seen Baskets yet.
Same concept. I mean, Louis C.K. is all over it. It just feels like a show that is about what's happening in the jokes come later.
Right.
But what was that experience like for you? Because what I really liked about it was there was this unspoken interest in each other. And it really was more than we see a lot on television. It was about acting.
Yeah, it's funny, you know, I never thought about this, but I felt like in that show, he also was sort of exploring this kind of the different layers of intimacy and connection and disconnection that we were just talking about in my music. So I actually felt very kindred spirit, kinship with him in terms of how our creative drives work. I mean, I'm not trying to pompously say I don't know.
No, but you connected on the idea that this was exploring something. It wasn't just a scene and you go home. You were exploring something the way that you were trying to communicate without language, that kind of stuff.
Yes. And he actually tracked me down for this part. I mean, he didn't have to go very far to track me down because we were parents at the same school. So we saw each other nearly every day. But he approached me. I had some hesitation about doing it, mostly because I hadn't acted in a really long time. Funnily enough, I had been having thoughts about, wow, it would be curious to try that again. But I never started pursuing it. It was just one of those way back. And I think what inspired me is there's been a lot of great television around, and I've seen some incredible acting on television and it inspired me. So then when he approached me, I had hesitation about, okay, I wanted to try this again, but maybe not on a national television show, like starring in a six. Not sure I'm ready for that. I'm a little out of practice.
Can I stand in back of a Batman movie and just kind of pretend like I'm looking at the building?
Or? Yeah. But then I had a meeting with him at his place, and we read the script. I mean, he had me read the script there with him, and I just thought it was brilliant. Like, I read that subway scene where he tells his daughters what to do in case. And then, do you remember that whole sequence? I'm not going to explain it, but all I'll say is when I read it, I was like, this is the same conversation I've had with my son a million times. This is too good. This is too real.
How much and your music, your career, obviously the television program, Louis, but it all centers around, there's a lot to do with place. New York City is a big character in that. And your career, you've played a lot of different places. I know you have a relationship with, when I look for your stuff, there's a good relationship with the radio stations and the media in New York City. But what does it mean for you to be an artist in New York City?
I mean, I just think at this point, I have no choice but to own it. I'm just a New York. I think I'm really a New Yorker through and through, and it's a very strong component. Part of it is that past growing up in the theater, being exposed to a lot of different kinds of art and music at that time, and like when you talk about, you can't quite pigeonhole my music. I think it's very much informed by growing up in this time when there was room for a lot of different
and growing up and living in different decades. I mean, New York has seen a lot of change.
Exactly,
right?
But really, I came of age during a time when it was like just so many different genres were mingling together, and so many different mediums, filmmakers with writers, with musicians, and different kinds of musicians. And I think that really, and the aesthetic of the theater too, was a big component in shaping my overall aesthetic, I think.
As we've talked about in this interview, you've had two lives. You've acted, you've played music, you've created music. Can you see a life without music, without acting? Could you move on to something else? I mean, let's say that tomorrow you're like, you know what, I'm a great painter. Or I'm a great accountant. Can you live a life without the arts?
No. Definitely. Why? 100%. No way. It's just it. It's who I am. I mean, it's in my DNA. I can't even explain why. I can tell you that I've tried a little bit here and there, and I was even very skeptical and suspicious of my inclinations towards pursuing the arts. I thought, are you just doing this because you happen to be in it and you want to continue that lineage? And I'm old enough now to say with absolute conviction, no, this is really who I am. It's in my cells.
Esther Balint's new album is Airless Midnight. She's touring the Midwest now. She's got a show tonight at the Hideout, 10:15, as part of Simfest, New York City, raised Hungarian-born. Esther Balint, thanks for being my guest tonight on The Download.
Thank you so much for having me. Really appreciate it.
Welcome back to WGN Radio. This is The Download. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, we're getting closer and closer to the NFL draft, which takes place here in Chicago. Can't wait. That first round night is going to be amazing. We're going to cover the draft with a broadcast featuring WGN Sports' Adam Hoge, OB, many others. The Bears are rumored to be interested in secondary help. Too bad it's not an all-time draft, because one man who could help this year's team instantly is former Bears safety Doug Plank. Plank epitomizes Chicago Bear football. Good old number 46 was a beast. Plank was drafted by the Bears in 1975, and he spent his entire playing career with the team. Plank instantly made an impact, leading the team in tackles his rookie season. To say he was aggressive was an understatement. Plank is best known for his cage-rattling, bone-chilling hits he put on receivers as they came across the middle. He was so well-liked by the Bears coaching staff that Buddy Ryan named his famous defense after him, calling it the 46. Plank retired after 8 seasons, missing out on an 85 Bears run. Since then, he's been a football coach and a businessman. He currently lives in Arizona, and he is my guest tonight on The Download. Doug Plank, welcome to the show.
Justin, it is great to be here.
This time of year, I mean, here comes the draft. Does it bring back good memories of 1975?
You know, it was so unbelievable. The fact that when I was at Ohio State, I really ended up being a backup. My first year of eligibility there, I end up tearing up my right knee, which required surgery, and it really put me behind all the other players that I played with for 4 years. So there was a time in my senior year where I'm playing behind an All-American safety by the name of Tim Fox, who had played 12 years in the National Football League, mm-hmm. and he got injured early in the game, and I got a chance to play against Northwestern in Evanston. And 2 Chicago Bears scouts came to the game that day, not realizing it, you know, that I had the opportunity of a lifetime. And I had a great day. I had 2 interceptions, recovered 2 fumbles. I made all the kickoff tackles on special teams. Then a couple weeks go by, I'm back on the bench again. So I'm thinking that's my career. It's over and done with. But fortunately, someone came and saw me. And I get drafted in the 12th round by the Chicago Bears. Wow. So it was really a miracle.
Coming to Chicago, what did you know of the Chicago Bears, especially at that time in 1975? What was your feelings about joining the Bears?
You know, having grown up in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, a very blue-collar area, and I always loved watching the Chicago Bears. Dick Butkus, just toughness. You know, I love the uniforms. And anytime the Chicago Bears were on, I mean, especially when Gale Sayers and Dick Butkus were there, they probably had the 2 best players in the league on offense and defense. And I just always admired the way the team played, because I really felt, even as a youngster, you know, starting to play when I was 8 years old, that was kind of like the football that I liked watching. And, you know, to get the opportunity to eventually come from Ohio State, get drafted by the Chicago Bears, was really just a miracle.
Doug, for you, I mean, you led the season, led the team in tackles your rookie season. But more than that, you brought that toughness to the team. I mean, you'll be known in Chicago as just a thumper. You know, like, you're the safeties that most fans want to see. What about that? I mean, was that something that you knew you were going to be? I mean, did you sort of play into the mystique of the Chicago Bears and Dick Butkus? What was it about you being that kind of safety?
When I finally got here and, you know, I came to the Chicago Bears facility and met Mr. Hallis and all the Chicago Bears, all that sort of thing. And I started to realize, wow, there is so much tradition and history here in Chicago. But I looked at the safety position, and the only player that really I even remotely knew of before that was Richie Pettibone, mm-hmm. who was a, you know, great big play guy, interceptor. But I kept thinking, why can't I turn that into like Dick Butkus? And yes, I'm going to be a smaller version, but why can't we bring pain from the safety position and bring that same attitude and, you know, same reputation? And believe me, Chicago Bears have a reputation. I mean, I've coached the National Football League with the Atlanta Falcons and the New York Jets. People respect the tradition of history and defense in Chicago. So I really felt like when I had the opportunity to get here, I don't care what I did, I had to put myself in the behavior of being a Chicago Bear. Having the opportunity to play special teams on kickoffs, I really would line up at 10 to 12 yards every single defensive play and just treat it like it was a kickoff.
Wow. Well, I mean, what does it mean to you? I mean, just saying all that, knowing the tradition, what does it mean to you to be recognized here in Chicago as one of those ambassadors? I mean, Doug Plank, we know you to be a defensive football player for the Chicago Bears. What does that make you feel, you know, after your playing career is over?
Justin, it's really pride, because there's been so many people that have come through there, and the reputation of the organization, and really just even to be considered. It was such an honor to, you know, again, play and start. It was an amazing thing, because, as I said, my time in Ohio State, I was always backing up someone. You know, so to get to Chicago and finally get an opportunity, I didn't have any baggage in front of me. I had never been injured there, you know, so I was coming in as just a rookie from Ohio State. And what can you do? And fortunately, I had a really tough coach Jack Pardee, who really loved tough guys and tackling and all those sort of things. And so he put me in a position and allowed me to, you know, start for the Chicago Bears that first season. And really, I was really learning on the job. I had never played free safety before, although I told the coaches at the time I did. And when you come in as the National Football League, hey, listen, you got to stretch the truth sometimes. You got to make believe and put yourself in a position like, hey, this is going to be my last week, my last game, and I am going to give everything I've got. And I always tried to pride myself on, when you watched me, whether it was the first quarter or the fourth quarter, you couldn't tell any difference.
Yeah.
Whether we were winning or losing, I was going to do everything I could to hit the receivers, the running backs, and sometimes even linemen.
You know, for you, I mean, you played such a physical game. I mean, that, your style of play was so intense. You only played 8 seasons, and a lot of that had to do with the fact that, you know, your body just couldn't handle it. And you actually left the Bears right before, you know, the Bears turned into the legends, the 85 Bears, the 84 Bears, things like that. Talk about that for you, because, I mean, a lot of what was happening around you in your final years were the building blocks for that dynasty. What was it like to be a part of that and to not be a part of it?
You know, I really felt like, even though I wasn't on the 85 Super Bowl team, it's ironic, Justin, how many times I talk to people, Bear fans, that still think I was on that team. They think I was on the Super Bowl team. Sometimes, not to try to embarrass them, I don't even say anything, you know, because if it's somebody I'm never going to see again, you know, really there's no reason in bringing it up. But the fact is, you know, the 46 defense, which Buddy Ryan created while I was there, and he named all these different blitzes and defenses after the people that were involved in it. And since I was a central player on this defense, I played right in the middle. Like, I was the Dick Butkus of the original 46 defense, and he called everybody by number. And someone could say, well, how did this happen? Well, Buddy never had X's and O's on the board. He always put numbers up there, and he referred to you either as a number or a nickname in meetings. And sometimes those nicknames weren't very complimentary. So I was very happy that he used to call me 46 all the time. And so even though I'll never forget the last day that I was there, Justin, walking out, I had just been let go. I had failed a physical. And he said, Doug, you've had a hell of a career here with the Chicago Bears. He goes, but I want to tell you something. Your career and your reputation is even going to get better with you walking out this door. He said, because the 46 defense, it's not done. It's going to keep going. And again, that was in 1983 at that time. And, you know, Buddy felt so confident that, you know, this was going to happen. And the team was in the right direction, and obviously it did.
Playing 8 seasons, failing the physical on the way out. I mean, obviously you played a very physical game. We've seen so much about football in the last 10 years where people are starting to question, you know, how the techniques, question, you know, the medicine or the way that players were treated. Talk about your relationship with the game now that all this is coming out with head injuries and concussions and the like.
Let me just say, I'm still a very, very big supporter of the National Football League. My life would be so different if I never came and played for the Chicago Bears, if it just had ended in college. I was in Chicago last week, Justin, and I was walking down Wacker, and twice, even on Michigan Avenue once, I was down there seeing several people that I was visiting downtown, and two people stopped me in recognizing me. I mean, come on, it's been 30 years since I played for Chicago Bears. It blew me away. I mean, the ability to be associated with the National Football League and the Chicago Bears, it completely changed my life. Buddy Ryan became the head coach here in Arizona with the Cardinals. And when I went down there to congratulate him, because he was now the general manager and head coach, I was offered a radio position. I mean, I was down there like 5 minutes, and they go, Doug, can you do our pregame and postgame show? I said, I think I can do that. So all of a sudden, now I'm a broadcaster. I have taken no courses. I have no qualifications. Other than just the fact that I was a player. And that started me down a broadcasting road.
Doug, do you worry about the way you play, the style of football that you play? Do you worry about life after football? Are you concerned about some of the things you see in the news with concussions and CTE?
Well, I think, you know, anybody should be concerned. I mean, like when I played, there was really no information out there to really be concerned about. Concussions were just mild inconveniences. It was such that I used to put you know, like aspirin in my pants, even during the course of the game, smelling salts, so that I just looked at a concussion as a minor distraction. And, you know, but I think we all have a responsibility. I mean, I have sustained some damage, obviously, from my body. I've had both shoulders replaced with titanium. And, you know, I've had one knee replaced and the other one needs replaced here soon. So I know I've suffered contact and collisions and all those sort of things. But I think we also have to have responsibility as individuals. You know, we live an entire life and all the things that we do in that life matter. And I think so that after my career was done, I did everything I could. I became engaged in running a business, operating several businesses immediately. It really kept me engaged, yeah. You know, mentally and physically in things that I had to do. So I think the important thing is for players, you know, to stay involved, stay active. Don't become, after your career is over with, you know, too many players, I think, really just turn into a retirement state and they just allow themselves to just not be engaged on a day-in, day-out basis. And I think it has a deteriorating effect if you continue to do that for too many years.
Let me ask you the last question just about, you know, if you knew what you knew now about concussions, about your body, your shoulders, your knees, all those kind of things, would you have played the game differently?
Here's the problem that I had is Doug Plank. I'm 5'11 and three quarters. I weigh 200 pounds. And I go out there on the field. I don't really see a lot of other people that are my size. They have the same dynamics, the same variables that I have. You know, I wasn't the fastest guy. I tried to be the strongest. I spent a tremendous amount of time in the weight room. But I had to take myself, Justin, and make myself somebody that wasn't me, mm-hmm. You know, not just physically. I mean, I did a lot of weight training, and I loved the weight coaches Chicago Bears had. Really became, you know, involved almost on a day-in, day-out basis. But weights helped me do my job better, and it helped me recover quicker, you know, after sustaining injuries. But here's the thing where I felt like I had to differentiate myself. I had to take my mental capacities and really put myself in a position where I was just suppressing my survival instinct. And what's that mean? That means you can go run at something full speed and you have no fear. You have trained yourself week after week, game after game, that you are going to run through the target that you're aiming at. And I was very successful at doing that, never slowing down, just continuing to run through that. Am I concerned about it? You know, I'm 63 years old now, and I think that if, thank God, I'm not in a situation where I'm experiencing some of the same problems that other NFL players are. We're all different. We're all built differently. I know from talking to doctors that installed my artificial knees that they said that my bone density was incredible, that I had bone density like nobody they'd ever seen. And I think maybe that made my hard head maybe helped create a sphere for me that allowed me to go out there and just do this game after game, play after play, and just never, ever stop.
Wow. Number 46, Doug Plank, one of Chicago's defensive greats, safety, played for the Bears for 8 seasons from 1975 to 1983. He's my guest tonight on The Download. Doug, great talking to you, and I hope we can talk again.
No, I really, really enjoyed it. And like I said, my job now is to just hopefully just try to touch one kid out there and make a difference. You know, just encourage him. Don't stop. Don't be distracted by somebody telling you you can't do it, because I'm a perfect example of a player that just kept going until I was successful.
Nice track. What do we got here, Pete? What's this one?
It's Jade.
Oh, yeah, Jade. Oh, yeah. I love it. It's a download here on 720 WGN. Coming up, Gary Cole. After the news, we're going to talk with the Steppenwolf ensemble member and character actor to the world. This dude has been in everything. And it's amazing. And he's such a tremendous actor. Right now, he's on the hit show, the HBO show Veep, which is starting up here on April 24th. I cannot wait. That's going to be one of the best. That's one of the best shows on TV. And Ro and Ann and I were talking about, you know, do they have to actually push it to be more, to be wackier
because of the real life politics that are happening around? Maybe I'll ask him that question coming up here, because maybe, you know, talk about, I mean, but what's interesting about Gary Cole is he joins a cast that, I mean, has Chicago roots. Julia Louis-Dreyfus, Matt Walsh is on that show. Sam Richardson's on that show, and Gary Cole. I mean, there is Dan Bacadall, who was on our program. Pete Gross is on it. Brad Morris has been on. So there's a tremendous amount of Chicago improvisers that are on that show. And from what I've heard from having the different people on, from Walsh to Bacadall, is that they encourage improvisation. They want to. And Julia likes it too. They want to do that. And they've got, I mean, Tony Hale's on that show. Buster from Arrested Development, he's so good. So we'll talk with Gary Cole about what that's like, because, you know, he comes from a theater background at Steppenwolf. I mean, he's been on Broadway, off-Broadway, Steppenwolf shows. He's been in scripted dramas. I'd love to know what his relationship is to improvisation. You know, he didn't come up through the Second City ranks and things. He came up through theater. He was one of the founders of the Remains Theater. Then he was a Steppenwolf ensemble member all the way into the it started, I think, in 1985. So that'd be a good question to ask him about, you know, his relationship to a younger generation of improvisers who are coming in and making stuff up on the spot, and how he reacts as an actor. So we'll talk with Gary Cole coming up here on The Download after the news. Yes, a download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. Coming up a little later in the hour, Brad Morris is going to join us, Second City Main Stage alumni, who is out in Hollywood right now. He's had a part in Dice on Showtime on Sunday. He also has been in several different things, including Bajillion Dollar Properties, which is on Cecil right now. So we're going to talk to Brad, our buddy, about what's up with life writing in Hollywood. Well, next week, the Chicago International Television Awards are coming up April 20th. That's next Wednesday. But this year, they're expanding their programming. From the 18th to the 20th, they're going to feature some great premieres, talkbacks, and appearances. It's all taking place at the AMC River East 21 here in Streeterville. They got a special screening of Empire with some of the cast, and then they're screening Patriot, Steve Conrad's new Amazon show. Steve was a guest here on the Big Table not too long ago talking about that program. But the crown jewel, it's got to be the screening of the first episode of the new season of HBO's Veep. This is season 5, of course, and in attendance, Chicago's Gary Cole. Oh, man, got to see that. Gary Cole's one of the best actors working today. The Chicagoan has been in several movies and television programs. The Park Ridge native got his start here in Chicago back in the late 70s on the stage, and he joined up with the Steppenwolf Theater Ensemble in 1985, where he's still a member today, and he joins us now on The Download. Gary Cole, welcome to the show.
Thank you. How are you doing?
I'm doing good. It's a pleasure to talk with you. How often do you find yourself getting back to Chicago these days?
I'm back there at least once or twice a year. I said most of my family, immediate family, is still in the area, so I'm always due. I try to avoid January and February, but I right. I make my way back there frequently.
Well, I will say that the text line and Twitter has blown up with people who remembered you from Rolling Meadows, who had crushes on you. That's all I've gotten in the last 10 minutes. Gary Cole's on, tell him I had a crush on him. That's all it is. So. Well, let's talk about your career. This is a big premiere to come back to Chicago, you know, as part of the television awards to premiere a show like Veep. What does that mean for you, who has such deep roots here in Chicago?
Well, I mean, you know, it's where basically I learned everything, at least on the ground floor. You know, that's where I had some of the longest collaborations with people. And I really think that the time I spent in Chicago on stage was the reason I was able to kind of last, you know, in the business in front of a camera. Because I think, you know, you just needed to be... I mean, I guess what's gotten me by, I guess, is somewhat being versatile. And, mm-hmm. and when I was in Chicago doing theater, you know, we did all kinds of things. And right. I was never really, you know, pigeonholed into one type of role or one kind of story and did all kinds of, you know, and drama and comedy. It was basically, you know, one or the other was always going on. So, you know, that the experience that I got and the people that I was fortunate enough to work with, some of which are still there and others went off to, you know, to either New York or Los Angeles or wherever, was invaluable for, you know, for my career after that.
Take us back to the early 80s. You coming into Chicago theater, you sought out Steppenwolf. That was a company that you looked to work with.
Well, I actually knew everybody that founded Steppenwolf Theater in college. Most of the people that founded the company went to Illinois State University, as did I. They were mostly a couple of years ahead of me. So I had met John Malkovich and Laurie Metcalf and Terry Kinney and Jeff Perry all at Illinois State. And then when I got to the city a couple of years later, I was fortunate enough to do a production in their first home, which was in Highland Park,
In
the basement of a church. And I think that was 1978, I want to say. So that was a few years ago.
But that's an iconic. I mean, that's Chicago theater history. That the basement of that church.
Yeah. They were there for, I believe they did two, maybe three seasons there. And then in 1980, they moved to their first base, which was the old Hull House on Belmont and Broadway. And then from there, they moved to, you know, Halston Diversey, and now they're in the home that they've been in for, I guess, it's almost been 30 years now.
You know, for you, I mean, you were a big, big part of the Chicago theater scene here for so many decades. And, you know, you haven't done much with Steppenwolf since your time in Hollywood, obviously, coming back here to Chicago, but you have done plays. Do you miss being on stage as regular as you were when you were back in Chicago? Do you miss that part of your life, being in the theater?
Yeah, I do. I miss I miss kind of the freedom of that, being able to, you know, have that many shots at something. You know, when you're doing a play, you're able to, you know, you can go out and have a bad night, but the great thing about theater is you can come back and fix that. If you do a scene in front of a camera, it's only going to be as good as it is that day. Mm-hmm. You're not going to get another chance at it. You know, the editor can hopefully save you, but sometimes you get a little bit, you can go a little deeper, you know, when you're on stage. I mean, I like both disciplines. It's not that I prefer one over the other.
Right.
It's just that the regularity of doing theater, it keeps you, you know, it keeps you on your toes. And I do miss that discipline of it.
Well, you know, we've talked to a lot of different people who've come up through the Chicago theater scene. We just, you and Michael Shannon on, and we talked about the fraternity that is the Chicago theater community. I mean, you've performed in L.A., you've performed in New York. Do you notice more of a community around the Chicago theater scene that you were a part of than, say, the other cities that I mentioned?
Well, I don't know that it's more about the fact that I was a part of a scene because that's all I was doing, and so were most of the people I was involved with, you know, and when you're doing theater, you know, for 3 or 4 years straight, I mean, I basically did theater with the same group of people, and that not being Steppenwolf, this was a company that I began called Remains Theater, which was with Bill Peterson and Amy Morton, who are both in Steppenwolf now. I mean, you know, that was the kind of life we lived. I mean, we were with each other 24/7 for, you know, 4 or 5 years. And so that's really a communal experience. And so that's something very different that, and I don't know that I'll ever experience that again, because I think that's a time in your life and an age in your life when, you know, those circumstances are possible.
Yeah.
So, but I do think there's something about Chicago being a city where it is, and it's not necessarily, you know, the headquarters of any kind of show business decisions, and yet it might be the most productive environment for artists in one sense, because there's a lot of freedom, and there's just it's for me, all I remember is that it was a great place to start. It was affordable, and the feeling of kind of camaraderie amongst everybody was was something I don't know that I've experienced anywhere else.
We're talking with Gary Cole here on The Download. He's going to be at the Chicago International Television Awards coming up here next week. There's a screening of Veep, which will be next Wednesday's the actual awards, but the 18th through the 20th at the AMC River East 21 over there in Streeterville. Let's talk about Veep, because, you know, we mentioned right before the interview just the concept that, you know, there's a lot of Chicago people. The DNA of that program, you know, a ton of Chicago
actors. That is true.
There's are on that show.
Chicago connection there, yeah.
And there's also like a feeling, and we've talked to some of the people about, you know, improvising and kind of going off script. For you, coming from more of a theater background, do you interact well with the sort of let's get another take, let's improvise, let's try to do some things off script?
It is for me, who did not come from that background at all. It was at first extremely intimidating. But although I had a little taste of it in the movies that I wound up with, simply because I wound up, you know, when you wind up in a movie with Will Ferrell, you're going to do some improvising,
right, right,
whether you like it or not. So it wasn't that I hadn't ever, you know, put my toe in the water. It's just that I'm not trained in that, and I still don't consider myself particularly skilled at it. But, you know, Veep is full of people who are, and so and who happen to be very generous with it. And so it is, you know, it is thrilling when it really works. And I have to say, you know, the primary use of improvisation for Veep is not necessarily in front of the camera. It's a lot of it is in rehearsal to actually generate material,
right,
that will be scripted in some form. It's not that there isn't improvising in front of the camera. There is, and there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of free takes, we like to call them. Okay, this is a free one, which is basically just, you know, throw the script in the corner. But it is still, for me, it's still, there's a bit of intimidation there, but I know that I'm amongst supportive friends.
It's
so
hard to believe that. I mean, listening to you, Gary Cole, talk about that. I mean, you of... you know, Bill Lumberg fame and of Talladega Nights and others, that it's an intimidating process, because you do seem to do comedy effortlessly. And it seems like it would come from the same spirit that we know of improvisation.
Well, it does, except that it is a bit of a different animal. You know, I mean, it is, you know, it's hard to put your finger on it, hard to describe it, especially if you're not, you know, if you haven't been trained in it. But it's different if that's not your background.
Right.
You know, it is, you know, there are actual rules to pay attention to that improve it, and sometimes, you know, those escape me. But we get a lot of help. I mean, and we have a terrific staff of writers who are able to, you know, use that form, and with their help, and all, you know, they just keep running in every 5 seconds with alternative lines to say anyway. So
that's great. You know, that's got to be great for you as an actor, yeah, right?
Oh, it's great. I mean, the script is never, you know, the ink on our scripts are never dry. I mean, they're you know, they're created almost, you know, on the spot sometimes. That accounts for the unusual tone of the show, I think.
Gary, you've done so much television and film, and you talked a little bit about it earlier, about the difference between being on stage and being in front of a camera. From a philosophical standpoint about approaching the craft, you know, I read somewhere you said, you know, that you kind of have a philosophy where you say you show up, you do your best, and then it's up to someone else and how they're going to actually digest that. And, you know, and that's not really something that you internalize. Do you pay attention to how your material works? Like, do you look afterwards, like, I hope that the ratings are good, or I hope that the movie is good? Or, I mean, is that truly your philosophy, that you do your craft, you do your work, you act, and then, you know, the next job?
Well, you hope for things to actually, you know, for people to connect to them, and you hope that they do well, aren't successful. But the only thing that is in your hands is what you can do. You know, the results of something are that, that's all I mean. The results of whether or not people connect to a movie is out of my hands.
Right.
I you know, if I do what I think works and that gets over to an audience, great. If it doesn't, there's nothing I can do about it. So I don't spend a lot of time wondering or worrying, is this going to be successful down the road, especially when you're in, when you're actually doing it. You don't want to think about that. The only thing you want to think about is getting this, you know, getting this note right. Are we all hitting the note that we want to hit, right, you know, in terms of all the writing, the directing, and the actors? That's all.
The last question I have for you here is Bill Lumberg. You've talked about that character before, the character from Office Space, the iconic manager. Are you at a point where it's one of the most iconic characters in American cinema history. People know it. They quote it. It's everywhere. I mean, I'm assuming you're stopped on the street all the time to, you know, saying, hey, there's Lumberg. What's your relationship to that character? Do you like that? Do you like the sort of the idea of you being sort of a hit, or is it getting old?
No, I don't think it'll ever get old to me. I mean, I think that, you know, if you do something that has an impact and then also just kind of hangs around for a while,
yeah,
you know, and it kind of stays in the consciousness, you know, there's people that, you know, work a long time and that, you know, that doesn't necessarily happen. And there's no, you know, that's the other, you know, like we were talking about before, the previous question. We all knew when we were doing Office Space that we thought it was good and we thought it was funny, but nobody had any idea of the connection it would make to an audience, because there's no predicting that. You know, that's an intangible thing.
Right.
But the fact that it did, I think everybody in the film, including myself, were thrilled about that, because it certainly kept me, you know, on radar, if you will, for the last 15 years. You know, whether or not you can identify with a character or not, you know. And Mike Judge was, you know, just a superb writer and director. And so I, you know, I'll always have a soft, fond spot for that movie and for that character, sure.
Gary Cole, my guest tonight, he's going to be, next Tuesday, he's going to be showing Veep, the premiere at the Chicago International Television Awards. It's going to be at the AMC River East 21 in Streeterville. Go check it out. That's awesome that Chicago gets a sneak peek before it premieres on the 24th. It's a pleasure to have you here, Gary, and thank you for all your work, and we look forward to seeing you on Chicago stages once again.
Thanks very much. Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Welcome back to The Download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. Brad Morris is a familiar name to Chicago comedy goers. He was at the Second City on the main stage, starred in their 50th review. He moved to L.A. a few years back, and now, I mean, you can pretty much see him on every sitcom there is. He has a recurring role in the hilarious USA show Playing House, which is going to have its third season coming up here. And he's currently the head writer of Bajillion Dollar Properties, an original comedy on CISO, the online NBC network, starring several L.A. comedians with special guests like Adam Scott, Patton Oswalt, and Nick Kroll. He's not only the head writer of that show, but he produces it as well, and he takes his first stab at directing an episode. Brad Morris, welcome to The Download.
Thanks for having me, Justin. It's good to talk to you. It feels like I'm in Chicago. I'm looking out onto Michigan Avenue right now with you.
That's right. That's the feel. That's what we're going for here, is that colloquial Michigan Avenue feel. All right, Brad, so let's talk about Bajillion Dollar Properties. This is a show that's gotten some great reviews, a hilarious show. How'd you get involved in this show?
You know, I sat down and met with Kulop Velisak, who, on top of having a fantastic name, is the creator of the show. And she was looking for someone to come on board who, you know, had TV comedy writing room experience. And Emily Wilson and I had written and produced on Cougar Town for a few years, and I had been writing on this Showtime show called Dice, mm-hmm, about Andrew Dice Clay. And I sat down with Kulop, and my wife and I are big fans of Million Dollar Listing and other guilty pleasures like that, and Kulop and I hit it off, and and she hired me.
The idea of this show is it is sort of like a parody of a reality show, like you mentioned. But it stars so many people that, you know, from Paul F. Tompkins down the list of Tawny to everybody. There's great Chicago connections. It just feels like a Chicago production.
You know, Kulop is a product of UCB, L.A., and so there's obviously some DNA crossover there. And, you know, between she and Scott Aukerman and Tom Lennon and Ben Garant, you know, these guys are all deeply rooted in comedy that has a lot of overlap with Second City and IO, and there's a lot of connection there. And I think that part of, you know, Kulop having me aboard was to make sure that she was, you know, bringing someone in who comes from that same place. And so that that was really exciting and made it really nice. And to be part of the audition process and be able to, I was sort of, both Kulop and I were the ones who were improvising in these auditions with these folks, and it was fun to see familiar faces and obviously, you know, Baltz and Tawny are, to have them as part of the show, I think really is important because it's sort of, Chicago is a big part of, you know, the improv and sketch comedy bloodline, and I think that was important to Kulop, which is really cool because she certainly could have been a person who said, like, I only want to have UCB people or I only want to have LA talent, and no, there's a lot of Chicago in there. It's great.
How much of the show is improvised? I mean, you're obviously the head writer, but the stock that's in that room, even the people from UCB and LA, they have such great improv chops. How much of it are you guys writing down? How much of the show was off the cuff?
So we spent months breaking stories the way that you would in a more traditional, fully written, you know, comedy room for a half-hour show. So these outlines are, you know, fairly specific and thorough and, you know, many pages long. And there are joke pitches within there as well. And then sort of what we do is, you know, we kind of let the actors look at the outlines and then they kind of go for it. And what that means is they use those outlines as a suggestion and we encourage them to improvise on top of it. And kind of the blend of the framework structure that we do in the writing mixed with people bringing what they bring to the table as improvisers is what creates the show.
That's sort of the way that so many shows are going, following in the footsteps of Curb Your Enthusiasm, that and which you've been on. But you know, is that something as a writer you like to be a part of? I mean, is that something you'd prefer over, you know, working on a show that's more standard kind of sitcom fare?
You know, it was really great for me to get to work on a show like Cougar Town and Dice and things like that, where there was a really great education in structure, as well as learning about tone in, you know, on one show versus another. But yeah, I mean, obviously taking this job for me was very much about getting to be a part of something where I could see all of my training and background come together in one place. And Kulop, certainly that was a big goal for her, I think, too. I mean, she doesn't come from a writer's room background, and her instincts are so fantastic. And it really was such a great room to be a part of. Yeah, it was to do something like this was something I've always wanted to do. Again, this, I was asked to be a part of Kulop's show. This is not my show.
Right.
I'd like to think I've contributed in some positive ways, but absolutely. And, you know, look, Tom and Ben are the, you know, members of the state, and as I know you know, and created Reno 911. And so Kulop and Scott and myself and Tom and Ben were able to take, you know, their experience and expertise and kind of use that as a platform, and then, you know, augment and build and change it from there based on what Kulop wanted to do. And, you know, this show has got kind of soapier elements to it, and again, kind of plays more with the reality convention than Reno did with Cops. But, yeah, I mean, it's going that way, and I think it makes a lot of sense. And certainly for me, I would love to get to do a show some point here that that combines story and improvisation. Absolutely.
Brad Morris, former Second City main stage actor here in Chicago, now writing for Bajillion Dollar Properties, Dice, so many other programs in Los Angeles. We'll continue with our conversation with Brad in just a moment. Stay with us at 720 WGN Chicago.
It's Download here on WGN Radio. I am Justin Kaufman. Well, coming up, we're going to talk with comedian and author Jen Kirkman. She's got a new book out. We'll talk with her. She's also coming to Talia Hall on April 23rd. And we're also going to talk with hard rocker Johnny Gioeli. Well, Brad Morris is our guest tonight. He's a head writer, and he's also directed an episode of Bajillion Dollar Properties, which is an original comedy on CISO, which is the online NBC network that, for those who listen to the Download, we had Matt Besser on talking about CISO not too long ago. Brad, you were a Second City main stage guy. You went out to L.A. You've had such success. You've done a lot of great one-offs on some tremendous television, and you've also had some recurring roles like you have on Playing House. For you, what do you see as the arc of your career? I mean, are you looking to find yourself your own show, the kind of thing where you write and direct and produce and star in? Is that the kind of arc you're looking for? Or, like, what challenges you? What kind of pushes you forward as a creative person?
You know, yeah, that would be amazing. I should conference my manager in right now. I think for me, it's sort of a not a Midwestern thing. So it's never been a very comfortable thing for me to kind of go like, yes, I would like to have my own show and it'll have my name on it and it'll be about me. And the truth is that I think I gravitated towards Second City and what that's about. IO and improv versus stand up because I really do like collaborating with other people and I like ensemble and, all that stuff. So, yeah, like, I think I kind of make my decisions, look, I came out here to act. I've been lucky enough to get cast as a regular in a lot of pilots and unlucky in that none of those pilots have turned into series, with the exception of Playing House. And then Dice, which is, I'll have a recurring role in that. And
that looks great.
Funny. And yeah. For those of you who are Dice fans, you'll enjoy getting reacquainted with him. And for those of you who are not Dice fans, you'll enjoy that his life is a complete disaster and that's what the show's about. But I would love to figure out, what that show is. And I'm working on it. It's sort of going to have to be a deal where I create something and people go, okay, I get why this is uniquely Brad. And then, look, I really enjoy helping other people bring their stuff forward, too. I really do get a lot of joy out of that. So I feel like I'm a baseball player, and I'm like, taking what they give me. I'm like, I'm a hitter. And so it'd be awesome if things lined up and I could do my own thing like that.
If you're a baseball player, you have a 2-1 count. I mean, you've got it's looking good. It's looking good.
Well,
they're going to pitch to you.
Well, listen, man, I hope from your lips to God's ears, as my mom says. So, yeah, man, no, it'd be awesome. And I'd love to do it in Chicago, to tell you the truth. And that's certainly a dream of mine, is to put in my time here and then, trick someone into giving me a little bit of money to do something there. So.
You said you went out there to act. I mean, you've had as much success, if not more, writing. I mean, you and Emily have been able to put together some projects. You have actually put together a great resume and really got the most important thing in Hollywood, which is experience. You've jumped from room to room and collaborated with different people, and you've been able to put together a resume. For you, how important is that experience? I mean, is it getting easier to jump from show to show and write in Hollywood writers' rooms?
Yeah, I guess it's sort of that thing that they always talk about. I mean, I know the Woody Allen thing is like, life is about showing up. And I think and that you always hear people talk about how, everyone tells, like, showbiz isn't like what you know, it's who you know. But the truth is, like, that's right. But I think people get it wrong and they think that it's like you need to know someone who's high up. And the truth is, like, you just actually need to put yourself out there and meet lots of people. They don't need to be Les Moonves and Larry David. They just need to be, like, literally, meet a grip, meet a cameraman, meet a makeup artist, and meet another actor and another writer, and like, put yourself in situations where suddenly you can be putting something together for yourself. Mm-hmm. As I'm speaking to you, I want the world to know this. I just let Kevin Smith merge in front of me on Melrose, and I want
so
you
Hollywood.
To know that he drives a silver Chevy Equinox. He's keeping it very real.
Very real.
And he's very svelte these days, Justin. I don't know if you know this, but
I don't.
But Kevin Smith, he's wasting away, and I mean, he's going to drown in one of these hockey jerseys before
that's,
he knows.
That's why we have you, Brad. I mean, that's you're our download celebrity correspondent.
Yeah. Anytime you want it, I'll just drive around, and you can just call me every week, and I'll just tell you who's merging in front of me.
appreciate the merge report.
Absolutely. Yeah, the merge report.
The merge report.
Maybe that's the show, man. You're now, see, you're co-creator, Justin. We just created the show. It's called the merge report.
The merge report, yeah.
It's a single cam, semi-scripted comedy for streaming because, you know, that's where you want
to be.
Full, you know, creative freedom, yeah.
You know, we had Dan Harmon in here not too long ago, you know, and he was talking about how this is the golden age of television for experienced writers, meaning for people at his level, you know, getting the opportunity to work in Netflix or Amazon or other CISO, they're used to not making money. That's what his joke was. He's like, we've got that down. And because we've had success other places, you know, money's not the end all be all. But it's a little bit prohibitive for new writers because, you know, you expect to come in and make a living and the living may not be there. For you as a comedy writer, I mean, you're straddling that. You're past new writer. You've worked on shows. You're now at a point where, you know, you have enough credits under your belt. Is it the golden age of television for a writer like Brad Morris?
I don't know if I know how to answer that, but I guess what I would say is if you're writing on a show, yes, I agree with Dan. There's less money. There are more shows, and because there are more shows, there's less money. It's definitely not like no one out here, you know, everyone's able to go buy themselves lunch. I just ate a $9 soup, and let me tell you something. I never once was like, I don't know if I can afford this soup. So in that sense, it's going great. But, like, you know, the way, I guess if you're out here to make a bunch of money, you know, yeah, I guess the way you do that is you still, you know, you become an executive producer and you, you know, on a network show, and you create a network show, and it's on for a bunch of, like, I worked for Bill Lawrence. Emily and I worked for Bill Lawrence for years, and it's basically in that echelon of, you know, I mean, network TV has changed so much. TV has changed so much, as you know, and there's like Bill Lawrence, Chuck Lorre, you know, there's a handful of these people,
right.
Greg Berlanti, there's a handful of these people that, you know, can take a helicopter to work if they want to, and then decide whether they're going to sleep in Malibu or the Palisades or, you know, go to the Hamptons for the night. And I don't think that's why most people come out here anyway. It sounds very Pollyanna, but the truth is, like, I really don't know what the hell else I'd be doing with myself. I mean, if I were still in Chicago, and I think about it plenty, I'd be probably clamoring to get a gig like you have right now and then hoping that I could figure something like that out and be very happy doing it. But, you know, I don't know. I mean, I guess my agents, you know, probably get a couple. It's, like, probably a little easier for them to, like, get me a meeting. Mm-hmm. But the truth is, the people that hire me more times than not, especially on the writing side, it's people that know me. Like, kind of, everything kind of feeds each other, you know? It's sort of like someone knows me as an actor, then they have me on a podcast, and then they know me through doing a show, and then they're like, oh, yeah, you write, too. And I feel like everyone kind of does a little bit of everything now, and it's probably means a little bit less money, but certainly to be complaining about the money part of it when you're getting to goof around all day and wear whatever you want is not the coolest move, you know?
Yeah. Well, Brad, you know what I'll do is I'll kick the merge report upstairs here at the Trib Tower, see what we can get going.
I'm telling you, man. Yeah. I'm telling you.
See if the Trib execs.
This is it, man. Is Sam Zell up? Who's even up there?
No, it's WGN America. I mean, they've got the hit show Salem. And a couple other shows here.
God.
So we could get something going here.
This is what I'm talking about,
this
man.
This is it. You nailed it.
Let's do the merge report, and then I think we can morph the merge report into, you know, something that's more, like, genre-specific and, you know, and turn it into, like, an hour long. And I'm telling you, Justin, you got your incubator right there, man. You just, you know, you should be knocking pitches around with people until you land on the right one. And,
there you go.
And then you're off to the races, man.
There
you
go.
Hire me.
Then we will hire you, Brad Morris. He is the head writer of Bajillion Dollar Properties, an original comedy on CISO, and he's also part of the show Playing House, which will be coming back for its third season soon. Brad, thanks for taking some time out, and thanks for the merge report.
Justin, thank you for the merge report, and thanks to Kevin Smith. I guess he's got to come on board as an EP. But congrats on the show, man. I've really been enjoying listening to it, and, you know, I'm a fan of yours. So congrats, and keep up the good work.
Thanks, man. Welcome back to The Download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, my next guest, comedian Jen Kirkman, is going to be at the Talia Hall in Pilsen on April 23rd. Kirkman just put out a new book entitled I Know What I'm Doing and Other Lies That I Tell Myself. She's a comedy force, from writing and performing on television to her Netflix special, which came out last May, to her podcast, I Seem Fun. And, of course, on stage, Kirkman tours her stand-up worldwide. She's been doing that for the past 8 years. Jen Kirkman, welcome to The Download.
Thank you for having me.
It's great to have you here. So, you know, let's talk about the book. I mean, the subtitle here is Dispatches from a Life Under Construction. What was the point of writing a book about your life under construction?
Well, I mean, this is the dumbest answer I'm going to give, but I'm an author, and just like J.K. Rowling does Harry Potter or someone else does crime fiction, I do real true story essays from my life that are revealing or whatnot. And so that's always sort of the genre that I'm going to do. So, and that's what my stand-up's like and all that kind of stuff. But when I originally started writing the book, my editor suggested that, you know, she thinks I'm a confident person with a kind of different kind of life that maybe not everyone lives. And she thought maybe to celebrate it and to make it even more of not an advice book, but like a something to aspire to or advice. And as I was writing it, I was like, I don't know if I have advice about how anyone should handle certain situations, because everything I'm describing is something that technically in the eyes of the world did not go well. And so I just was like, as I'm writing it comes to me, I feel like sometimes a piece of road that is under construction and people drive by go like, when are they going to fix that? And so I thought that would be like a funny subtitle. And then I think it just sets it off as like, this is not a how-to book, or certainly like a, you know, people who've written things, it's like, you know, I've really figured it out and I want to share it with you. Like, that is not what I want to share with people.
But that's what makes it so relatable. When you read it, you're like, yeah, these are stories that can happen to anybody. And I think that's what makes a book like this from a comedian, especially someone who has such success as you have, work.
Well, I'd like to be relatable, or else I don't think it's that funny, you know, to be like, I'm not Oprah, right? So I'm not going to be like, so yeah, I mean, my goal is not only to appear relatable, because I am relatable, but is to, I don't know, remind people, I feel like, and it happens to me too, people that you know in your everyday life don't really tell you the truth about what they're feeling or what's actually going on. And so if I can do that, then maybe that person sitting in bed reading it is like, oh, I'm not the only one.
Well, you're the best-selling author of I Can Barely Take Care of Myself, your other book. But your stand-up is a very open, shared experience. I mean, when you do stand-up, it feels like you're telling us about your life. I mean, you're off the cuff. In the book, at the beginning of the book, you talk about how you're actually pretty fiercely private. Talk about that balance about sharing and putting yourself out there in public and retaining your private life.
I mean, I guess I'm doing, like, a good job, I suppose, of making people think that I'm really telling them everything, but it's just like any other kind of stand-up. Like, it's carefully constructed. Every single thing is written. Like, when I'm coming up with new material, I definitely improvise it first on stage and then kind of perfect it later in the writing. But I never, you know, reveal too much. I don't. It's hard to explain without giving the examples of the stuff I'm private about. But it's like, I think we've all gone through breakups or divorce or been to an annoying wedding or, you know, we're really thinking this, we're worried about this. I don't say anything that I would be ashamed. You know, like if you've ever gotten drunk and kind of don't remember something and you wake up and you're like, uh-oh, I sent that email out and you really wish you hadn't. I never feel that way when I get off stage or anything like that. I'm really careful with what exactly I reveal. And usually it's more like my thought process, like, oh, I went into this situation thinking this, but then it turned out that. So the only way I guess I can say I keep a good balance is I just have good boundaries. Like, I know what would be harmful to other people, harmful to me, and it's like plain not funny. You know what I mean? I think if something's too deep, I think an audience can be like, we're not your therapist, but come back again with some jokes. Thanks.
Ani DeFranco was on the show, and we were talking about how her experience at her show, I mean, she shares a lot. She's up on stage. She's performing, but she's also telling stories. She's talking off the cuff about, you know, politics or social issues. And that has changed for her over the years at the advent of social media and technology. People are taping everything and being able to puppet back. I mean, that's something that happens to stand-up comedians all the time. We saw it with Hannibal.
Yeah.
You've been a victim of that. I mean, at some point, do you have to recognize with all these different platforms, whether it be a podcast or, you know, on stage or a television program, that you have to have boundaries as a performer?
Yeah, I think it's important. And I know it's so weird. I wish I knew how to explain, but I'm just picturing her being able to have this intimate moment with however many people are there, whether it's 80 or 1,000 or whatever, and just being like, you know, there's nothing that she's ashamed of saying. It's not that, that's not why she doesn't want it on the internet. But usually when you're part of something for the night, you understand the context of it, mm-hmm. and you understand, oh, here's a person who's maybe just read something in the paper this morning, and they're trying to process it, so they might talk about whatever, Bernie Sanders followers or Donald Trump's rally or something. And maybe they don't get it right, or but they're just being a human in front of us, and, oh, we had a great time at the concert, and then everyone goes home, and that's it. Now someone puts it online, everyone reads it out of context, then they only really read the headline of whoever wrote the description of the thing, and it's like, oh, it can cause a lot of outrage, and it can make it less special, even if you're just a fan of hers, when you go and show up. And so it's really not happened to me too much. I've had some people tape record my shows, and or like someone was periscoping something live once, and it's just not, they can't do that. I mean, I don't know how to explain why they can't, yeah. but there's rules at clubs that say do not videotape, and people will put it online, and it's not that it's not worked out, but it's just not, that's not how I would present it on YouTube if I had the choice.
At one point, I mean, it feels like you almost lose control of your own material. There's a story out today that I read that, you know, the guys at the theaters, at the AMC movies, they may just let people text. They just might say, you know what, people are doing it anyway. It almost feels like you can't stop it. You can't stop people from taping your show. You can't stop people from moving.
They gave up pretty fast.
Yeah, right. It took a little bit. But what do you do as a stand-up comedian if you know that there's this almost this, you know, huge boulder moving down the road that can't be stopped? I mean, you have to adapt and figure out, is it going to change your act?
I mean, I just can't even put myself in that position of really worrying about it that crazily. Like, I don't find it happening that much because we just have people policing stuff. But, you know, you have ushers and waiters or whatever in the clubs. I mean, I really just don't see it on my level that much. Maybe if I were in a stadium and I were huge, although I don't think that's a whole other story that I have played stadiums as opening acts for other people and I don't enjoy it, so I don't know if I would do that on my own if I got to that level. But I don't know. I would cross that bridge when I come to it. I mean, my first instinct is like, then I don't do stand-up anymore, and screw you. You guys ruined it. Like, oh. Everyone put their heads down because one kid in class. So, you know, I won't adapt anything. I won't adapt an art form to a bunch of idiots with their phones. No way. I'd rather just not do it. I'll go do something else. I'll just keep writing books, or I'll, like, who knows. But no, I won't adapt it.
In the book, the I Know What I'm Doing and Other Lies I Tell Myself, we're talking with author Jen Kirkman. You do, you know, replace the names, you change things, but you do talk about some things that are relatable. You talk about your relationships. I mean, you're open to an extent about your relationships in the past, present, and future. How hard is that for you to do when you're writing it down in a book, I mean, as opposed to performing it on stage?
Well, I don't talk about relationships on stage, really, which is sometimes I do if it's a crazy story. Like, I do have something in the book that I have done on stage, which was about one night going out with someone much younger than me. And I was, you know, joking like I was a cougar for a night. But that is, for some reason, I just don't do that kind of material on stage unless there's something funny about me in it. But in books, yeah. I think it's easier to, like, I have a story in the book about someone I went out with, and the red flag was there from the beginning, that he was kind of a needy person that just wanted to be in a relationship, and he was trying to change me, and he was very annoying, but my friends thought, oh, he's the greatest person because he offered to hang up pictures in your apartment. It's one of those stories that's supposed to illustrate when people only have some of the details, they'll push you towards something because it's a romantic idea. And that's funny on paper because I can get into these descriptions, but on stage I sound like the person that's just making fun of someone else. And so I think there's some things, and I don't know how I decide, it's just instinct, that I know, you know what, on stage in the context of telling jokes, unless I was doing a one-woman show or something, on stage this is just going to sound like me making fun of someone, as opposed to it's a longer narrative about the psychology of something, blah, blah, blah. That is so much easier to put into a book. We can take our time with it. I can explain it and defend myself and all that kind of stuff.
You know, in the book, you talk about relationships. You talk about your life. You have some great essays in here. You also talk about women in comedy. You talk about Joan Rivers and your relationship, but also your love of Joan Rivers and what she did for comedy. It's a great chapter and a great essay about what Joan had to go through, but also what you've had to experience in your own life when dealing with watching some of your peers, men who are doing stand-up, get shows, do this, do that, you know, before you do, just based on the on your gender.
That really was like a quick throwaway line in that chapter. What I was trying to say more was comedy's hard for anybody, and there's a part in comedy where you can be doing it much longer than, there's no fairness, you know, and that's a good, that's, I'm not complaining about that. That's just literally how it is. It's not a school you go to where you get a grade and you can't get further if you don't get the grades. There are some people that will make it, quote unquote, very quickly and others won't. And I think, you know, maybe what I didn't make clear enough in that chapter was I was just a young, whiny kid in my 20s. And Joan's story resonated with me. And I'm glad it was. So Joan, you know, pounded the pavement, did stand up 10, 12 years before she got any notoriety, and she was at the time the only woman doing it in her peer group, and I certainly wasn't in mine at all. There was an equal balance, but that frustration where you see other people moving on without you, it's not that you're jealous that they're famous, but you're thinking, well, if everyone in my peer group is getting paid to do this now or getting work in television, maybe I'm not good. Maybe it is just these people at night at the bars and restaurants that like me, and I'm fooling myself. It's more that kind of thing that you have to ask yourself, and it doesn't necessarily mean you're bad and you should quit, but there is something frustrating when the numbers of people doing really well start to almost snowball, and generations starting after you start getting things, and you're like, oh my God, is this ever going to happen? And so I said men in there, but I said it because Joan was literally the only woman in her group. For me, it was men and women and, you know, dogs, cats. I mean, there was a time when things were going really bad, and I'm glad for some reason that her story of staying with it stuck with me instead of me thinking, oh, what a loser. I wouldn't put that much time into it if I don't make it. You know, I hear people say, if I don't make it by 30, I'm quitting. I'm like, well, then you'll be quitting. So I think that that's the hard part, is just sticking with something when you're not getting paid to do it and you have to do another job on the side, and just not knowing, like, maybe I'm not good. There's no one to tell me. I always think, like, if your comedian peers think you're funny, then you're doing okay. You'll get something eventually, because they won't lie to you.
The book is called I Know What I'm Doing and Other Lies I Tell Myself, Dispatches from a Life Under Construction. The author is the New York Times bestselling author, Jen Kirkman. She's going to be at Talia Hall in Pilsen on April 23rd. Jen, thanks for taking some time out, and good luck with the show.
Oh, thank you so much. And I should just tell everyone, it's a fun show. It's like crazy stories that aren't from the book about me being an idiot in life. And so that even includes a terrible dance to a Beach Boys song. I think people will like it.
All right. Coming up, Johnny Gioeli's going to be here. Got to talk to him about Hardline, about Brunette, about Hard Rock. I had a good thing. It was we talked to Johnny about Hard Rock. It was another H, and hair. That's what it was. What was the other H? There was a good H. There was a second H in there. Hard Rock, history, and hair, maybe? Would that work? Johnny had some good pictures back in the day. Like the late 80s, Johnny had his long hair. It would look good. He looked good. So we'll talk to him. I'm looking forward to this. I was a big Hard Rock kind of fan in the 80s. You know, I like hip-hop music as well, and I like some country, jazz, blues. But there's a special place in my heart, kind of like, you know, I guess it would have been high school aged, growing up in Wonder Lake, Illinois. So we'll talk to Johnny about Hardline and about the, maybe it was Heartbreak. Hardline, Heartbreak, and Hair. Long, beautiful hair. How about that?
That's why you have to carry a notepad.
I know, but that one was
good.
Gotta
jot this stuff down.
I know. That's pretty good. I'm going to stick with that one. Welcome back to The Download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, my next guest is New York-born hard rocker Johnny Gioeli. If you're a fan of heavy metal, you know the name. Johnny fronted the band Hardline, which back in the early 90s signed a major label record deal and was being marketed as the next big thing in the hard rock arena. Well, as we heard from Lita Ford, who was on the show a couple weeks back, the rug was pulled from under rockers when grunge bands like Nirvana and Pearl Jam came on the scene. Hardline went from music darlings to out on the street in a matter of months. But that didn't stop the band. They continued making music and playing festivals all over the world. The band members that have come and gone read like a rock history book. Members from Journey, the drummer-producer Bob Rock, and some others who went on to play with Ozzy Osbourne, just to name a few. Earlier this year, Johnny Gioeli announced he was back with a solo career. He's crowdsourcing a new record. Johnny's currently on tour in Germany, and he joins me now. Johnny, welcome to The Download.
Hey, man. Thanks. How you doing, Justin?
I'm doing good. So, you know, it's interesting because we did have Lita Ford on not too long ago, and she talked about the plight of a lot of hard rock bands in the early 90s and how it really was the rug was pulled under in a matter of moments. You guys were kind of in the thick of that. Is that accurate to say?
More than accurate, man. In the thick of it is an understatement. I remember we were in the studio, we were recording the first Hardline record, Double Eclipse, first Hardline CD, and a very big name in the industry, John Kolodner, who signed like bands like Guns N' Roses and many others, said, I want you guys to listen to this band. It's a band called Pearl Jam. And he played some of this music. He said, this is all you're going to hear on the radio. This is all you're going to see on MTV. And we were like, get out of here, man. What are you kidding me? And in a flash, we were gone, and the entire scene changed. And that, so that is a very accurate statement. We then went out and exchanged our spandex for work pants, and we climbed poles and worked on electricity. No, I'm just kidding. We actually took our music, and we went to the senior center, and we played for the old age people.
There you go. Well, let me ask you, because
it really was an upset, though.
Well,
that's for sure.
I mean, you guys have spent, I mean, you personally had spent years in hard rock. I mean, you were in other bands that were part of the scenes and that we've read about in the 80s in Los Angeles and New York. You've played so many different stages. I mean, one of your bands broke the record, Van Halen's record, at one of the clubs. I mean, your whole career was moving towards this moment of signing that major record deal and getting radio play. So to have that happen at that time, it's just unfortunate.
It's true. I mean, I worked my entire life. I started playing professionally at 11 years old. I learned about music and picked up the guitar at 8 years old, but literally as a drummer before I was a lead singer, played at 11. So I was laser focused. I don't remember many days in school. I had tutoring and the whole thing. So this was my life. 1,000,000%. It's all I thought about. It's all I did every single day, every night. And so, you know, to make that dream, you know, become reality, that's what it was all about. And you finally get there, and we had a sizable record deal. You know, we had a $8+ million record deal. That's a lot of cash for a new band. Mm-hmm. And you're there. Finally, you're there. And the work really begins at that point. You release an album. You do pretty well with it. And then all of a sudden, guys, we're not going to do another record. And you're like, wait a minute, are you kidding me? And you know what's wild about it, Justin, is it's not the money that freaks you out, a musician out. At least I'll speak for myself. It was worrying, agonizing, many sleepless nights about, am I not going to hear the sound of that audience again? When those lights go out, brother, and you hear that, you know, of 20, 30, 40,000 people, not to have that in your blood, that's a scary thought. That's like I needed therapy after that. And so after that all happened, I needed some downtime to kind of like, you know, regroup mentally, because I was so fearful of not ever hearing the sound of that audience again more than anything. I didn't care about the magazines I was in or the MTV or any of that stuff. It was about the people. Am I not going to see these people in the audience again? That's what was my worry.
There were so many bands that were coming up. I mean, obviously the success of bands like Guns N' Roses and other bands like that, where there was a crossover, it almost felt like there was a movement away from glam rock, the makeup and the long hair and the spandex, as you mentioned, to a more sort of biker rock kind of thing that Guns N' Roses was doing. And there were a lot of bands at that time that were trying to jump on that bandwagon. You lived both lives, and you actually had some trouble with the way that the music industry was marketing you guys, because you had long hair, because, you know, you sort of fit the profile of or the look of the glam rock. They wanted to sort of make you more like the bands Poison and bands like that. Talk about that experience of being in the music business and the marketing angle of it.
Yeah, that's true. And we were sort of linked to that whole glam scene, and we were not a glam band. We were so poor we couldn't afford a haircut. But no, that's not accurate. But no, we were thrown into that whole genre, and it wasn't us at all. We came out of that and just went directly into Hardline. See, Hardline started when we met up with Neil Sean. Neil Sean was married to my sister, and they were together for many years. And we never leaned on Neil for any musical help in the industry at all. And one day we were one day it was a holiday. We were at Christmas time at my home on the East Coast, and my brother and I, who was in the band, started playing some music. You know, we're playing a song called Face the Night that's on one of the Hardline albums. And Neil comes running in and saying, "Hey man, let me see the guitar. You know, let me try this, try that." And after a short talk, Neil said, "Hey man, I want to produce this thing." And you know, so we had a totally different vision. Hardline was going to start with going to be my brother and myself as a you know, what we were calling brothers. It was like a hard rock version of Nelson. And so everything just kind of morphed into this, what the record company perceived as this glam band once all these other long-haired guys joined us. And it wasn't that at all. And then the flip side, which was also so agonizing, is once the Pearl Jam and the Soundgarden and all those bands came out, the record company said, "Hey, we believe in you guys. You can conform to that. You can do that. You're talented. Right. You can do that." And we're like, "Wait, man, it's not about conforming. It's not about filling your bank. It's about being real and true to the music."
How do you stay true to that? I mean, how do you, as someone who's, you know, you're getting a sizable record deal? I mean, that's the music business, as we've been told, conform and try to hit trends.
Well, I'll tell you how we bowed out, quite honestly, Justin. We said, "No, we're not. You know, I don't sing like that. We don't write like that. We're out." And we said, "Well, we know that our fans exist. They're worldwide. And we may not play to 25, 30,000 people, but we're going to play to people who love and appreciate what we do." And we stuck with it.
You took some time off. And from about mid-90s to 2000, there was no Hardline. But you came back. What was it that brought you back?
I needed money. No, I'm kidding. sorry, man. Can I ever be serious? No. Honestly, after that time period, I played around with different members, and that's it can be a mistake. I tried to regroup Hardline using different members, and when you have Dean Castronovo and Todd Jensen from, you know, who played with Alice Cooper and Ozzy, and you have Neil Sean, of course, from Journey, you just can't replicate that. But I tried. I wasted a lot of time there. But also, I needed a departure from it. I needed to kind of regain my strength, my energy, my mindset. Just imagine, so 11 years old, and then into my young 20s, all I did was music, try to live that dream. I make the dream happen. Rug gets pulled out from under your feet. And you need some therapy, man. I needed some time off, and that's exactly what I did. I just relaxed, regained, refocused, waited for the industry to kind of settle, and then said, "You know what? I'm going to do what I do, whether it's accepted by a record label or not." And that's it. And then the world changed with the internet, and bye-bye labels. We don't really need them.
Right. Well, let's talk about now, because you're back with you're going on a solo career. You have a new solo record you're working on, and you've decided to crowdfund that, which we've seen a lot from musicians and from writers and creators in here that are doing the same thing for television and film. What's the move to do that? I mean, obviously you need resources and you have a fan base, but what does that provide you? You just talked about being true to your music and true to your voice. Does that do that for you? I mean, is this going to be an authentic project for you?
Yeah, well, what it does, Justin, is really phenomenal. Something that we've never had to, we weren't able to do in the past, is to connect with the fan. So the fans have always been in the on the sidelines, And everything was so secretive in music. You never knew where Van Halen was recording. You didn't know when they were recording, where they were recording. You didn't know where they lived. You didn't know how they lived. And with this whole social media movement, I think it's the coolest thing that musicians now can be real and they can be true to their fans. So, you know, the reason I wanted to do this, two main reasons. One is I've never been a social media guy. You know, I just got a Facebook page not too long ago. I've never been it. But I said, you know, the fans deserve this. They deserve to know. They deserve to see. And I found out about this platform through a friend of mine called Pledge Music. I said, okay, wait a minute. This is a great opportunity to touch all these people, communicate with them, let them see how it works, let them see how difficult it is. It's not easy to write a record, to make a record, to record a record, to master a record, to promote a record. It's not easy. So that's the first aspect of it. The second aspect that I love about it is that it's charitable. And we have a dear family friend named Joe Barber, 17-year-old kid, very close to our family, dove into the water and accidentally hit a rock in the Long Island Sound. I live on the East Coast. And he's paralyzed from the neck down. And there's a million charities, as we know. Yeah. But this one's in my backyard. And I had to do something. So I said, wait a minute. This now is a platform where I can create a record. I can invite the fans to witness the creation of this thing, be there right along my side, and it's charitable. I can give donations that are pledged towards the record to this family who really needs the help. That's rehabilitation great. For someone with a spinal injury, yeah. $8 to $10 million over their lifetime. So those are the key reasons.
Johnny, let me ask you, you know, and I know you're going to be coming into town in the fall for a tour, but when you think back to the decades that you've been performing music, especially rock music, and you think back to those times, the spandex times, as you referred to, the long-haired times, what's the emotional response to that? Are those good memories? Are those bad memories? What's it like to think back to bands like Hardline or Brunette and other bands that you were in?
Well, I think they're great memories. They're great. I mean, look, was it difficult? Absolutely. The old cliche, starving artist, believe every word of it. But was it a great experience? Was it an amazing accomplishment? I thank God every day when I had that record deal. And I used to tell my now wife, we need to be thankful every single day because this just doesn't happen every day. So let's enjoy this. And I did, man. I didn't take anyone who knows me, any fan that knows me knows I at least try to give 120% at every show because I care. So I have great, great memories. I also have some pretty ugly stories, too, but I'll stick with the great memories.
We'll get the ugly stories. We'll get those out of you next time.
Yeah. In the studio, I'll share a couple. It's brutal.
Johnny Gioeli from the band Hardline is putting out a solo record. You can find out more at Pledge Music, and we'll put that stuff on the website. Johnny, thanks for taking some time out from the German tour, and we look forward to having you in studio come fall.
Great to be on the air with you, Justin. You do a great job. Thank you, man.
So what did we learn tonight on the download? I was thinking that would be a good way, like a Doogie Howser kind of end. Play the song. Mike Fouché told us about the police board. You know, like if we actually did the work to sort of rehash the entire show. We realized that maybe making recommendations is easier than it seems. Maybe like Esther Ballant taught us about connection. And why sometimes it's not the music or the acting, but the art pushes us forward. Doug Plank rattled the cages of many receivers over the middle. But what he remembers most is about how you, the Chicago Bears fan, rattled his cage in a good way. Just keep going, right? What else have we got? It was 9 o'clock. It was Gary Cole told us he doesn't want to be anywhere else but on stage here in Chicago. At 8:30 or 9:30 was Brad Morris in the Merge Report. Brad taught us that if you just let go and start meeting people, taking meetings, and build your relationships, anything can happen.
All right. Next.
Jeez. Jen Kirkman taught us, not everything is for the stage. Some things are for in here, your heart. And Johnny Gioeli told us, sometimes you make it to your dreams and they don't come true. But it's up to you to get up and make sure that you try again. And then there was something about hair and spandex in there, too. I missed that. But that'd be a great bit. We should do that at the end of every... what did we learn?
We would learn a lot.
Like Doogie Howser, like the old Doogie Howser.
Let's do it.
All right, we'll work on that. All right, tomorrow night, the Chicago Blackhawks, game two. That's a win. They're going to win that one.
Let's hope.
Yeah, I watched that game last night, and it stunk of... It just felt like the Blackhawks, even though it was 0-0 the whole game, it just felt like the Hawks were winning.
Yeah, oh yeah.
And so, that's what hockey always gets me, because you can have those kind of freak occurrences, and then you lost. And you're like, okay. You know, so, I mean, I feel good, like, watching the Blues, and if that's going to be their game plan, if that's going to be their strategy to kind of hit,
mm-hmm.
And I don't think it's going to work. I think we saw not unlike what Scott was talking about yesterday come to fruition. I think the Blackhawks have a chance. And with Duncan Keith coming back, you get a little bit more defensive savvy.
Yeah.
Savvy.
They didn't have much offense coming from their defense.
Yeah, exactly. Like, they need to push that. So I think they'll come back. I think you won't see a 0-0 anymore. I think both teams are tight. But that's tomorrow night. Next week, the Blackhawks will be, you know, they're going to be game four, game five, game probably game five, game six, we'll see. But we're not going to be here. Pete and I will be out. Mm-hmm. But Amy Guth will be in, I believe. And it depends on the Blackhawks game, so I don't want to throw things out there. But I know James Van Ostel's name was thrown around.
Mm-hmm.
Was it Bubala?
No, Dane Neal.
Oh, Dane Neal. Dane's great. I miss Matt. He's always fun to have on. But they'll hold it down.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as your favorite R&B singer says, I'll hold it down.
They'll do it.
They'll hold it down. So, but we'll be back the week after with some great, great stuff we're already working on.
I'll keep him in line.
Yeah, exactly.
Slap him around a little bit. Hey, Van Ostel.
You know,
Pete and Justin don't do it that way. Knock it off.
Knock it off. Exactly.
No, but Bala, Justin wouldn't have asked that question.
You
that
should
way.
Have them do the wrap-up. You got to make sure at the end of each show they have to do, what did we learn today? Like the Doogie Howser thing. Make them start it.
Yeah, exactly.
Have them start it, and then we'll just
see if it works.
See if it works. Let them workshop it.
Yeah.
And then we'll come in and do it the week after. I like it. All right, that's going to do it for us. Patty Vasquez is up next with Pretty Late with Patty Vasquez. This is Chicago's very own 720 WGN Chicago and WGNRadio.com.